Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Kate Burdett. Coming up, the Franklin County Auditor's Office recently released tentative 2026 property values. I'll speak with County Auditor Michael Stinziano about what that means for property owners. Jay Fox will speak with experts about ideas for kids' summer fun, the drinking habits of Generation Z, and how to decode the Declaration of Independence. Plus, Doug Petcash of Face the State will have a look at state politics. First up, on Columbus Perspective, the Franklin County Auditor's Office recently released tentative 2026 property values for every parcel in the county as part of the state-required property value update. Soon, property owners will also receive a mailed notification with their tentative value. And because of this, today we are joined by Franklin County Auditor Michael Stinziano to kind of get down to the nuts and bolts of this. Hello, Auditor. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate the opportunity to talk about this important process.
It is an important process that I think maybe needs a little bit of demystification for some folks because we hear about this, but what exactly it means is another question. So let's start at the beginning. A property owner in Franklin County maybe doesn't want to wait for that that interesting information to come in the mail. How can they look that up right now?
Absolutely. The tentative value, and so it's value, not taxes. That's always a good place to start as well. But the tentative value is available on the auditor's website. We have a one-stop shop, all things property value update process called the Know Your Home Value website. And we encourage any property owner to go there now in Franklin County, look up their tentative value and learn more about this important process.
Why is the property value update required?
Well, because the General Assembly requires it, it's the quick answer, and it happens every 3 years, also required by the General Assembly. And then it kind of, when you dig under the further into the layers, part of how property taxes do get calculated rely on the property valuation. So 35% of the auditor's final valuation combined with the taxing district, so that's what property owners vote on or the community votes on, is how we get to that calculation when the treasurer, not the auditor, but the treasurer sends out that property tax bill.
Okay, so when you're doing the appraisal process, are certain neighborhoods grouped in certain ways for that purpose?
Yeah, so it's a three-year process, and the minute we end the last requirement, we begin looking and implementing the next update. This one's a three-year look back, essentially, relying on essentially neighborhood sales. It is not the big one where we go out and review each property. And so we take the entire county, look for similar features, similar age and housing stock, other amenities, so maybe a high-performing school district and an entertainment district, hospitals, and then update the valuation based on all of those components.
So when a property owner is looking at this tentative value, what does it mean and what does it not mean?
Well, as I always like to remind folks, it does not mean property tax increase. What it means is this is where we're at right now, the tentative value from the auditor. So if you're looking at that value and reflecting, is this in the range of where I potentially could sell the property? Then it's probably the right valuation. However, if you're looking at it and you say, hey, this looks too high, this looks too low, we want property owners to work with the auditor's office and make sure we get a fair and equitable value. When you go to the Know Your Home Value website, because once people learn that value, then they want to know, what's it going to do to my taxes? We do have a calculator where you can plug in the auditor's value, tentative, or any range if you think it should be up or down, and the impact it has on your current taxing district and what impact it could be on taxes. I remind folks often under Ohio law, your value can go up, your taxes can go down. Your value could go down, your taxes go up. So much is driven by what's occurring in that taxing district.
So if a property owner sees a tentative value that they don't necessarily agree with, how would they go about scheduling a property value review to reflect their property's value?
Yeah, so what we are hoping is any property owner that sees a tentative value and feels it's inaccurate to go to the Know Your Own Value website. You can schedule a in-person, we'll be at various locations in July, August, and early September, sit across from a table with an appraiser. You could also just submit documentation for us to review. So say there is other sales or conditions in your home that you want us to be aware of, or you can also schedule a virtual meeting with an appraiser. All those features can be found at that Know Your Home Value website.
Is there anything else in the realm of property values that we haven't touched on yet?
Yeah, I think it is important and for people to understand, particularly in Franklin County, the value increase is not a one increase in your taxes. And so letting folks know where they may see an increase, you still can have a tax decrease. And so using the calculator, understanding how the auditor's valuation combines with the taxing district is really important. You want, in my heart of hearts, folks do want to see their property value increase, but we do understand their concern about the economy and what impact it could have on taxes. And so we want them to understand that relationship as well. So that's why the calculator's there, but the auditor's office is available to answer any and all questions when it comes to the relationship between the value and their potential taxes.
Franklin County Auditor Michael Stinziano, thank you so much for this information today.
Well, we appreciate the opportunity to share that. And again, if anyone have any questions after they visit the website, please don't hesitate to call the auditor's office.
And that website where you can find the property tax estimator and much more information about property values is auditor.franklincountyohio.gov/KYHV.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's Jay Fox.
In Central Ohio, summer is here. So is the heat, and the kids are out of school. Our friend Elizabeth Werner, who's a child lifestyle expert, joins us again on Columbus Perspective with some great ideas to keep our kids active, entertained, and safe throughout the summer months and beyond. Always good to have you, Elizabeth. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you so much for having me back.
Absolutely. Now, Elizabeth, not everyone has access to a pool. How can we have water fun at home if we don't?
Absolutely. Listen, I grew up in Mansfield, Ohio. We had all of that great old-fashioned fun, right? We did the water balloons, but the most classic was the old-fashioned garden hose and the sprinkler. So all of those fun things, a lot of the toy companies within the industry are making really fun attachments for those to have great sprinkler fun. You can get a little splash pool that is wonderful for the kids to have fun in the yard. I definitely encourage some of that free form play throughout the summer months.
I grew up in Shaker Heights, and the hose was a huge part of our summer as well. With soccer,
by the way, also how our parents expected us to hydrate.
Well, that's true. You drank from the hose. You didn't have any concerns about it.
That's right.
With soccer on everyone's mind this summer, with the World Cup and such, what can you recommend for kids that are interested in those activities?
Yes. So something very, very exciting from Jazzwares. They have come out with the FIFA World Cup 2026 Squishmallow and Plush collection. Now, Squishmallows, if you don't know, I'll tell you, are the kids' favorite soft, stuffy, plush stuffed animals. They collect them, all their favorite characters. Well, to celebrate the FIFA World 2026 host countries, they've come out with the official mascots in their soft form. So we've got Clutch, the bald eagle, of course, representing the USA. We have Zayu, the jaguar from Mexico. And then Maple the Moose from Canada. Now, these are soft, they're squishy, they're fun, they're playful. And between being their favorite plush and the excitement of the world's biggest soccer tournament, these are going to be great to collect, to gift. The kids are going to have fun with them. They also have this really cute referee visor, Jay. The kids are going to put this little visor on. Sitting on top of the lid of the visor is a tiny referee, very cute, sunglasses on. In his right hand, he has a red card, left hand, a yellow card. And when you squeeze these little arms, the cards and the arms move up and down. So it's just fun and playful. I think the kids are really going to get into it.
I have a feeling someone's front yard is going to be turned into a soccer pitch with all of these stuffed animals lined up on either side as the spectators.
Yes, I love it. I love it. And we're going to project the games onto the garage, right? Get all
sure.
The neighbors over together. I mean, good old-fashioned fun.
Just somebody needs to yell goal at the top of their lungs. All right, aside from soccer, what other summer outdoor activities do you recommend for kids?
So there's a new item that I have fallen in love with. Kids absolutely love the movies How to Train Your Dragon. Well, the most beloved character, of course, is Toothless the Dragon. Well, they've come out with a real flying RC Toothless. So this Toothless has a 30-inch wingspan. It is a remote-controlled dragon that your kids are going to launch. It has a 250-foot range. The remote control is really simple. It's made out of a very strong, durable foam. It's lightweight, so not going to hurt anything if it bumps into anybody. It's got a rechargeable battery. And I just say, when we were young, right, we all went out, we flew kites. I still love kites. It should be a staple. But this is going to be that kind of item where you take the family, you drive over to the field that's nearby, you launch this, and everybody's running around and having fun and watching this dragon just fly through the sky. And I think it's magical.
Okay, that takes my two-piece plywood plane with the rubber band and throws it right out the window.
Now, listen, we need it all, don't we?
Yeah, we do.
The classic, the fun. Yeah, we need it all. Now, I will say this. As a mother of four, the one thing that summer also always reminds me of is we're going to be outside. There's going to be a lot of sun. We really need to be prepared, right? We need all the big stuff, the sunscreen, the calamine lotion, the first aid kit. So Walgreens has set up such an easy way for us to pick these things up and to grab them. They have where you can order and pick it up in 30 minutes. They'll deliver to your house within an hour. That's my favorite, I think, now that I'm thinking about it. You can shop on Walgreens.com or you can hit up your favorite neighborhood store. But as parents, we need to be prepared for everything. And I think that that's going to be the easiest way to get it done.
Now, here in Central Ohio, it is already very hot. So a lot of kids are moving inside. Are there any indoor recommendations besides movies and screen time?
Yes. So I like to set up the classic areas for the kids in the house, right? So depending on the kid's age, I like a craft area that's got markers and scissors and paint and all of the fun things that they can do to really explore their creative sides. I like to have an area for the little ones that's all dress up. Maybe some musical instruments. They can make their own band, just the way we all used to do. I'm sure you remember. And then I think a section of the house that's set up for the builders. Whether, you know, you're playing with Legos, you've got those wooden blocks. For the kids that are little, you know what? A pot, a pan, and a wooden spoon make a great drum set.
Now, you talked about How to Train Your Dragon, which, by the way, is one of my favorite movies. I think the series is great. But there are lots of other toys associated with movies, including Toy Story 5, which is coming out soon. What's in your toy chest this summer?
Okay, so I'm very excited about that, and I think that, those toys are going to be sought after, and they're going to fly off the shelves for sure. We've also got Paw Patrol. Keep that in mind as well. We're very excited about that. A little bit of Paw Patrol with the Backstreet Boys, maybe having some involvement in that. The kids are going to absolutely be looking for those toys. That always remains a staple. We love that program in this house, and that's going to be something that's going to be really picking up as well.
Now, for folks that are listening and couldn't scribble down all of this information that we just threw at them, let's give them a website where they can go to ask their questions and get more information.
Absolutely. You can head to our website, which is WernerInfo.com.
WernerInfo.com, WERNERInfo.com. We want to thank Elizabeth Werner for being with us, as always, and for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
We live in Columbus, Ohio. We're a college town. We're known for drinking. I'm Generation X. We drank a lot. My daughter, she's Generation Z. She doesn't drink so much. It's an oddity. America's drinking habits are changing. Julian Braithwaite is the CEO of the International Alliance for Responsible Drinking and joins us now on Columbus Perspective. Thank you for being with us.
Good afternoon, Jay, and thank you very much for having me on your show.
What does it mean that Gen Z is the dry generation?
So it's really interesting. We've been carrying out this research into how American drinking habits are changing, but particularly looking into the start of the summer with the Memorial Day weekend. And, you know, it is definitely one of the questions that we were looking at, which is, you know, are Gen Z drinking or not? Now, They're often called the dry generation, but our research shows that's not quite right, because 75% of Gen Z in this survey were saying that they would be drinking this summer. So it's not that Gen Z aren't drinking, but one of the things that comes over really strongly in this survey is just how intentional they are planning to be about.
What do we mean by being intentional? Are these folks making a plan before they even go out? Are they discussing and thinking things while they're at a restaurant before they even order? Or has this just become part of the fabric of their DNA?
So with Gen Z, I think we're seeing something of a shift in mindset, with drinking being part of, a balanced lifestyle, being, things like control and well-being and wellness being important in how they think about it, and drinking sort of complementing the occasion, complementing the experience and not defining it. And this being particularly important for Gen Z, but something that we're seeing is increasingly important for all generations.
There is a particular moniker that I don't understand. You're going to have to define it for me. What is zebra striping?
So one of the things that came across in this survey were the ways in which Gen Z is redefining drinking and drinking moderately. And a couple of terms came up. One is zebra striping. The other one is nonna maxing. But zebra striping is the practice of alternating an alcoholic drink with a non-alcoholic drink. I think you guys would call it zebra striping on this side of the Atlantic. And it's actually, one of the old, age-old ways of drinking moderately, which is to stay hydrated and not drink alcohol throughout the evening. But it's particularly possible now, and there are more ways of doing it now, because of course there's lots of no and low alcoholic products that people can alternate with. So they can go out for a beer with their friends, and they can then follow up with a 0.0 non-alcoholic beer. So that's zebra striping. Nonamaxing, on the other hand, is the habit of having alcohol over a meal with friends and with family, maybe staying at home, and for alcohol to be part of the experience, but not defining it, with really socialization, spending time with good company, good food, and with alcohol being a way of enjoying alcohol in moderation. Of course, this harks back to something that is a very old tradition. Nonna is the Italian for grandmother, and it harks back to something the Italians have been doing for generations, which is drinking as a family, drinking over meals, drinking moderately with food and in good company.
Is moderation something that is happening because it is a health conscious choice, or because the laws have gotten more strict about operating a vehicle while intoxicating? What is the driver behind all of this?
Well, we've been seeing sort of moderation playing out in the national statistics for some time in a good way. So underage drinking in America is down by 40% since the early 2000s. Drink driving is down by, again, 40% since the 1980s. So you've seen progress and moderation becoming more mainstream over time. But it's driven by intentionality. It's driven by a desire to be more in control, to make your own choices. Cost is part of it, particularly for young people, but it's not the driving factor behind it. So it's a number of factors, but really wanting to drink as part of a balanced lifestyle is something that we're seeing cropping up again and again.
At the beginning of the show, I mentioned that we're in Columbus, and Ohio State University has long had a reputation for being a drinking campus, as has Ohio University down the road. It used to be that when you went to college, drinking was a part of the collegiate experience, whether you were in a fraternity, sorority, or you were an independent. How has peer pressure changed when it comes to drinking for the folks that are entering college today?
So, Jay, I think we're of the same generation. I think we're Gen X, and I think I've got kids who are Gen Z as well. And there is a change. And I think one of the big things that's changed is, at least when I was growing up and going to college over on the other side of the Atlantic in England, you know, I'd go out to the pub with my friends and we'd buy each other rounds, which meant your drinking was sort of really defined by the group you're in and everyone was drinking. Now, and this really comes through perhaps, you know, most strongly of all in the data in this survey, over 9 in 10 Americans say that actually making up their own mind about how they drink, choosing for themselves and being self-directed about drinking is very important for them. So the days when people just went along with the crowd, I think, have changed. And this data really underpins that.
Is this trend something that can gently influence the habits of the alcoholic?
Well, you know, this is a really important point. And, you know, there's a big distinction between drinking in moderation, which is low risk, and harmful drinking, which is really where, you know, all the problems lie. And the key thing is, it's two things, really. One is that people know about drinking moderation, know their limits, know how to drink moderately, and stay there enjoying alcohol in a low-risk way with their friends in a way that's sustainable and not harmful. And then, you know, you do need to have the policies that tackle the harmful drinking. You know, that's why cracking down on drink driving has been so important. And, you know, America has been doing this, and it's one of the ways in which countries can really make progress. It's also about enforcing a legal purchase age, again, something that's you've seen happening around the world, in America too. And that's how you reduce that, the harmful drinking that can lead to the sort of problems that lead to people having, you know, a lifelong challenge. Drinking in moderation, low risk, harmful drinking, definitely something that that should be, you know, should really be tackled firmly. And getting that balance right means that, you know, the vast majority of people can then enjoy alcohol as part of their lives in a low risk way with their friends.
It should be pointed out that the International Alliance for Responsible Drinking is a global not-for-profit that works to reduce harmful drinking and help people make informed choices about alcohol. But curiously enough, it's supported by the world's major beer, wine, and spirit producers. How did that happen?
So these are big companies with global reputations, and they have brands, some of which are, you know, are hundreds of years old. So they have a real stake in their products being consumed responsibly and in moderation. And the last thing they want is for their products to be abused and for them to be contributing to, you know, harmful drinking. So they're really committed to this, which is why IARD was set up. We are involved in helping promote moderate drinking and an understanding of that. The companies themselves play their part, along with government and civil society, in tackling harmful drinking. And IARD is a UN-recognized NGO which participates in these international processes as part of the representatives of the private sector in how government, civil society, and the private sector can come together to tackle harmful drinking. So these companies, they're commercial companies, but they definitely see it in their enlightened self-interest to be supporting responsible marketing, responsible advertising, and the responsible sale of their products.
Given the marked change between our generation and Gen Z, as we go forward in time, do we think there will ever be a time where non-alcoholic choices will be the preferred choice and the alcoholic variant will be in the minority?
Well, we'll see. I mean, I think, people have been drinking for thousands of years, and my guess is that, you know, people like us will be talking about people drinking alcohol in the decades to come. So I don't expect, and this is what this survey shows, that alcohol will be, you know, will be eliminated from society, like, you know, Europe or the United States, but that actually this trend towards moderation, where alcohol is still part of society, still part of enjoying a drink in company, that continues, but in a way that reduces that harmful drinking that we were talking about earlier. And that's got to be a good thing.
Absolutely. We want to thank Julian Braithwaite from the International Alliance for Responsible Drinking for joining us. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox. Thanks so much for listening.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Jay Fox.
Just finished a fascinating book called The Declaration Decoded, a guide to the document that inspired our nation by Katie Kennedy. For history buffs like me, it was a great refresher, but for new people, it's a powerful text that looks at the Declaration sentence by sentence, idea by idea. Katie joins us now on Columbus Perspective. Good morning.
Good morning.
I loved the book. I loved how it was to understand, and I liked the breakout sections that you did when you took the double truck half below page and thoroughly explained what we were talking about in that subsection.
Thank you. Yeah, it was a challenge to make it accessible to modern readers, but we thought it was important.
So what does the book hope to bring about in regard to government rights, responsibilities, and freedoms?
Well, we're hoping that to take this document, that we're celebrating its 250th anniversary, right, and the anniversary of our nation's birth. And so few Americans have actually read it. And so few Americans who have read it have really understood it. So we're trying to make it accessible, to explain the structure, to explain the language, the context in which it was written, which is so important, and make it so that not just kids, but also adults, it's meant as a book for kids, but also one that people my age can get some benefit from and understand better our nation's history, where we've been and where we're going.
Another century ago, I was an American history major at Ohio State. And
hey, good for you.
Well, even that being said, as much as I thought I knew, I learned quite a bit. For example, let me ask you this question, and we're going to give it away, but you still have to read the book. How many grievances were there against King George III, and why are they so important to understand our country's history?
Well, there are 27 in the final document, which is completely coincidentally the number of amendments to the U.S. Constitution. But obviously that has no significance. It's just maybe you'll win a quiz show sometime with that. It started with 28, and Thomas Jefferson, who wrote the draft of the Constitution, which the Second Continental Congress edited heavily, put in a condemnation of the international slave trade. That's the 28th document. He went through and made the grievances more intense and more offensive as he went through. When he made the 28th one, the slave trade, although, of course, Jefferson himself, a slave owner, and Congress struck that. So they wound up with 27 grievances. And ironically, many people simply did not understand what they meant even at that time. They're not just sort of obscure to us today. A lot of people at the time weren't quite sure what Jefferson was talking about with this or that grievance, but taken all together, they made them mad. They felt their rights were being violated. And Jefferson wasn't trying to explain something. He was trying to justify it. He got people hot, and it's what he was trying to do.
One of the things that we take away from that Declaration of Independence was a strong rebuke against taxation without representation. But that is not the whole story. What are some of the Declaration's misconceptions, and how do they impact our civic life today?
Yeah. One of the biggest misconception, of course, is simply confusing it with the Constitution. And you come across that over and over again. The Constitution, written after the United States existed, after it had tried the Articles of Confederation as a first way to govern ourselves, and that was proved to be too weak. So then the delegates went to the Constitutional Convention to write that document that has the force of law. It's the highest law on our land. The Declaration does not have the force of law. It has the force of poetry and principle. Pauline Meyer, a historian, calls the Declaration American scripture, which I think is just right. And Abraham Lincoln called it the electric cord that binds patriotic hearts. It's binding the hearts of, isn't that beautiful?
Somebody else called it an ode to American ideology, and I can't remember who that was.
Ooh, I can't either. But that works. You know, it embodies America's basic political principles. As a reminder of who we are and what we stand for, and what people of that generation were willing to risk their lives in a very literal and immediate sense for. I think it's important for us in that way. You know, Caesar Rodney, delegate from Delaware, was needed. The first vote failed because Caesar Rodney was home, and they went to let him know he needed to come back. He rode 80 miles overnight through the dark, no streetlights, right?
Yeah.
To get there and walked in. It's almost impossible to. I asked a friend who's an equestrian about how you would ride 80 miles. She kept thinking, I don't think he could quite do it. And I'm like, you don't understand. He did it. He did it. He crossed six rivers at night and so on, and strode in with muddy boots, which people were kind of shocked about in that generation, right? And walked in and cast his vote for independence. People felt that strongly. Caesar Rodney had cancer, and his best chance of survival was a doctor in Britain. And that avenue was cut off to him as soon as he signed his name. So he might have been signing his death sentence in an immediate sense. And he rode 80 miles for a chance to do it. You know, what is it that is so important about that? People need to reread this document and remember what it is that makes us a people and what it is that binds our hearts.
All right. True or false? Unalienable rights was likely a typo.
True. Jefferson's original document, his draft, said inalienable, which I think reads better.
It does.
And after Congress got done editing it and cutting 25% of the draft and, you know, breaking Jefferson's heart. No writer wants to have to sit there and listen to people edit their work. It was still inalienable. But when it got published as a broadside, it was unalienable. So whether the printer simply made a typo or just decided to edit Jefferson's document a little bit, we're not quite sure. But
on my computer keyboard, I and you are right next to one another. So who knows?
Well, there you go. I don't think he was using a computer keyboard, but
obviously
you never know.
Not. All right. This year we celebrate America at 250. What is the most essential idea we as citizens should remember as we celebrate this milestone?
I think it's important to remember that we have political principles, that we have not always lived up to the nation we aspire to be, but we have always tried and should keep trying. We need to remember that there is no second-class citizenship. The colonists were upset that their rights were being violated, and they were correct. They were. Things were being done to them that could not have been done to someone who lived in London or Oxford or Edinburgh. And that idea that they would not accept second-class citizenship, I think, is an important one.
The book is called The Declaration Decoded, A Guide to the Document That Inspired Our Nation. I read it in one read. It's a really easy read. The author, Katie Kennedy, we thank you for joining us today. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan, now courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10TV. Here's Doug Petcash from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10TV.
The City of Columbus is working on new juvenile safety legislation. In early April, Columbus City Council and community leaders held this public hearing to talk about ways to keep young people safe. As part of it, they discussed youth crime and violence. City Council President Shannon Harden said that night he's working on legislation addressing the city curfew, truancy, and parental responsibility. Then, 2 weeks ago, a massive teen takeover forced the cancellation of St. Catherine's Fun Fest in Bexley and ended with nearly a dozen arrests. Police say as many as 130 cruisers responded. The takeover spurred more talk about tightening up the city's curfew. City Council will discuss the new legislation at its meeting tomorrow and the following Monday, June 29th, when it is expected to vote on it. Joining me now to talk about the issues and the new legislation is Columbus City Council President Shannon Harden. Sir, first of all, thanks for being here and happy Father's Day to you.
Doug, same to you. Thank you so much for having me for this very important conversation.
Absolutely. You're welcome. First of all, now that a couple weeks have passed since the big incident at St. Catherine's, and you've had time to maybe digest it a little more, what are your thoughts on it? What are the takeaways?
that two things can be true at the same time, that at the end of the day, these are young people and that we don't want to overcriminalize anyone, but also that we have to have, we have expectations and for safety of our young people, but safety for our community as well. And that we have to make sure that those community norms are set, that those expectations are understood, and that at the end of the day, that if safety is our number one priority, then the safety of our young people and those that they engage with has to be at the top of our priority list. And that's why we have been having this conversation well before the St. Catharines event.
I do want to be clear that this has been going on, the discussion with you and other leaders about juvenile safety. So you're talking about new legislation.
Yeah.
First of all, so what is included in this legislation?
So, first of all, a lot of folks don't even know that we have a current curfew of the law. Now, we have not talked about it much, and maybe so because it starts at midnight.
I was going to say, I guess we should say it's midnight for 17 to 13-year-olds, right?
Midnight for 13 to 17-year-olds, which I think we can all agree is too late. That has not even been up for debate in any of the conversations that we've had. What we are looking to do is update the current curfew law for 13 and under, juveniles 13 and under. The current law says that it's after sunset. Well, sunset changes. That's a weird way to enforce. So we're going to just say 9 p.m. for 13 and under. 9 p.m. will be the curfew. For those 13 through 17-year-olds, we're taking the curfew from midnight to 4:30 a.m. I'm bringing it to 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. All of these requests are on behest of not just community leaders and parents, but also our chief of police, mm-hmm. who said that if you look around the country, we actually were an outlier when it came to curfew laws being on the books, but also enforcement.
Why is it necessary?
Well, again, I think that it's really important as a community that we set community expectations and norms. In our city, what do we expect or what do we think is a safe time and place for our children to be? What we also are doing, going a step further, is moving forward with parental responsibility mm-hmm. component to this curfew enforcement. The first offense is not a citation. It is education. Mom, Dad, do you know that do you know that the curfew has changed?
Yeah.
And two, we are bringing your child home. We are connecting you back with your child to make sure that they are in safe being. But if those continue, if the child continues to be out, continues to break curfew, continues to engage in other activities, then the engagement with the parent will increase to encourage them and with support to make sure that they know.
Are you talking about fines or
it will things like it will that? Go to a fine?
But after so many
after
violations,
after a certain number of violations, we want to make sure that this is not punitive. That we know the strains that many parents have. Folks are working later. Folks have different challenges. We do not want to be punitive. We want to be a partner. What I've said before is I actually want the first engagement of correcting a young person's behavior to be from a parent, not a police. And the best way that we can do that is to support the parent in playing that role. We are setting these norms, setting these expectations for Columbus, saying that we are not just going to have a safe summer, but this is our expectations throughout the year.
So you're not looking at then as a hindrance for a parent, but changing the curfew as kind of a resource for them to say, hey, you know, letting their kids know that this is what the expectation is.
My son's only 5 years old, but we already sometimes get into that negotiation stage. This is for the parents. Sometimes you have to say, you know, it's not on us saying that you have to be in by 10 p.m. The city says you have to be in at 10 p.m. This is an additional support to all of those folks who are raising young people. Again, these are norms that we are saying in our city, this is our expectation. And we don't think that this is a silver bullet. We think this is part of a much larger list of comprehensive reforms that we want to take to keep young people safe.
And speaking of that, you're also talking about a truancy aspect to this, too, for missing school.
For sure. This is, again, we started this conversation last July. We understand, again, if you're talking about safety being our top priority, nothing can be more important to our safety than our young people. We know that curfew laws impact safety, but we also know that truancy is the first indicator of a young person going off track. It's also a first indicator of a young person going off track in school, not even in violence. And so we believe the city, and we just held last week, our first joint committee hearing of the Columbus City School Board and the City of Columbus.
The new partnership.
This will be one of those conversations that we center there. How can we, the city, play a better role at supporting our young people while throughout the school year? And so we are working to move this curfew legislation on June 29th.
You expect it to pass?
I do expect it to pass. I'm asking my colleagues for their full support. I know we have a lot of support from the community. We also want to make sure that we don't just center enforcement as the only thing that we are doing. We have to remember that we put out tens of millions of dollars for youth summer programming to make sure that there are the also additional resources. We have our pools open. We have our library and reading challenges going. So this is a piece of the puzzle. It is not the end game to how we believe we'll keep young people safe.
You preempted my next question, which is, do you feel like the city is doing enough to give kids the other alternatives, other opportunities to stay out of trouble, I guess?
I don't know if the word is enough. I think we always have to do more when we invest in young people. But what I do know is that there are options and opportunities out there for young people.
Again, that's courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV, from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV. This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan, heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS FM 97.1 The Fan and on 1460 AM, The Fan 2.